Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, yes. That is crystal, clean. Mate.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, can you hear us?
Oh, these fucking Spurs. Oh. Got you.
Oh, you can hear us.
Oh, you dickhead.
Welcome to episode 8 of the Run of Play podcast. A fresh take on football with no filter, no censor, and no suits. Alongside Liam, Elliot, Cameron, and myself, Abby, is Copper 90 host and director, Ellie Menjam. Ellie will be talking us through some of his crazy experiences, his journey into becoming a filmmaker in the football space, and we'll look ahead to the international break.
So, thanks for coming on the show, Ellie. For those that might not know, Cameron and I actually work with Ellie at Copper 90. We haven't been in the office together, sadly, because of everything going on. But we have missed our lengthy footballing discussions. It's just not quite the same over Twitter. So we thought we'd get you on so everyone else could hear them too. For those listening, could you sort of give a quick intro into your career in football and sort of what you're known for and what you do?
Yep. So, I'm Ellie. I'm lucky enough to work with you and Cameron. seven years ago, I won a competition to host a show at the Confederations Cup in Brazil, 2013. And then that went so well. It was a competition with Copa 90, the football media network extraordinaire. And then basically that kept the job from there and just moved to London and traveled the world documenting kind of niche football stories, mainly derby rivalries and internet and stuff on the international break. I'd say that's the majority of stuff amongst other, you know, UK football stories and general European stories.
Yeah, what was the competition?
The competition was called The Best Job in the World. You haven't seen the video?
I'm going to pretend I haven't for the benefit of the podcast.
It was a meme. It was basically a meme in the office by now. But I basically me running around my apartment in Australia going on about why I love football, but not as you know it, not for a club, but for supporter culture and fans and how I lived it 24/7. And people seemed to like it enough to go, all right, well, you deserve to go to Brazil. And then, yeah, that was 7 years ago.
Nice.
A lot's happened since then.
Yeah,
Quite a bit's happened since then, yeah. Yeah, so I haven't seen that apartment in a while.
Cool. So yeah, we just wanted to talk a little bit about sort of more recent football news and what's been going on over the last week or so. We were texting you throughout it. I don't know if anyone here wanted to talk about the Man United game.
Sure.
We might have an agenda for that.
I mean, we've got quite a big agenda for discussing United picking apart, which was obviously also followed up by Liverpool's hammering by Aston Villa. So horror weekend for both. But Ellie, how good were Spurs and Villa this weekend? I mean, you would have to be living in a hole if you didn't watch either of those games.
How good were Spurs? And also, I think Villa were pretty good, yeah, as well. No, they were incredible. I actually texted Liam watching match of the day going, okay, now I see what you're saying about Son. He really is the real deal. Like, you guys were brilliant, man. And I think there's way too much attention on how bad United were and not enough credit. Because I actually didn't realise you guys were up 3-1 when the red card happened. I thought you only won so convincingly because you United had 10 men. But turns out you were storming them far earlier than that. So Lamella, you guys, come on, honestly.
I mean, we all know it's obviously not a red card, but, you know, Jose asked them to be intelligent, you know what. So I guess his plan's kind of working out. But let's take nothing away from Villa as well. We have to give them a special mention because to, you know, go and pick apart, you know, some of the best defenders, you know, in the world right now, you know, Champions League winners, Premier League winners. I mean, that's quite a feat. So take nothing off of them. They were just outstanding.
Only Spurs could get overshadowed beating United 6-1 by
the
same exact, not even day, just like minutes later.
It's like, hold my beer.
Yeah, we're going to do this better.
I never thought of that. Like, you guys had about an hour's worth of kind of headlines before Aston Villa took them.
Yeah, but fair play to them. I don't know which ones. I think definitely
Villa one scout. Crazy.
They have improved a lot. I mean, Ross Barkley coming in and, you know, obviously Grealish signing the deal. It's definitely good for them.
I didn't think they'd improve that much.
No, just with Barkley
not
coming
that
in.
Much.
Just Barkley can add seven goals to their attack.
But
Mane didn't play, did he?
No.
Mane or Alisson.
Or Henderson.
Or Henderson. So,
but I just didn't, I never noticed this high line thing that's just suddenly come in for Liverpool, where everyone's picking apart the high line. Was it something, I don't know, I didn't maybe watch them too much in detail before, but did Liverpool always play this high line? Have they,
I think they did,
just people just figured them out?
I think it's like, I guess Mane is very important to them, obviously, goals-wise, but then they also, like, he sets the tone in terms of the press. Like, he is literally, it's like a, you know, he just runs about, he's absolutely on defenders' toes, like, making sure that he's setting the tone in terms of the press. So when you don't have pressure on the ball, when you don't press people, and then you just let them have time to then pick you apart over the top, and, I mean, Joe Gomez had a bit of a horror show. And so did Van Dijk, to be fair.
But even with Mane in the weeks before, they were still struggling. Like,
they've conceded a lot of goals so far. Yeah. Albeit looking good against Arsenal. But against Leeds, it was very touch and go for a while. Leeds could have taken that easily. Mm.
I am glad, though, because it does kind of mean, unless they adapt very quickly to this, the fact that everyone's figured them out, that the league's going to be a bit more wide open this season.
I think it's going to be very wide open.
Makes it more interesting for neutrals.
Definitely. I think one thing I wanted to ask you, Ellie, obviously yesterday was deadline day. I know it's sort of like completely against all of your sort of like football coverage and what you do. I just wanted to know sort of like what you thought about it, and like do you hope that Sky just sort of like give it up? We were talking about it a bit before, and it's pretty depressing how they managed to like drag it out into a 14-15 hour show.
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to happen, because I feel like transfer windows give fans so much hope and despair that it's part of the culture now. I think what I found more depressing was just realizing things like Edinson Cavani, despite being a free agent, cost Manchester United £10 million in agents' fees. I was reading today about Sancho, about how essentially they wanted an extra £30 million, euros, I should say. The agent wanted €30 million from Sancho to get the deal across the line, and it just kind of made, what's made me really sick is just how much I'm realizing agents' fees are playing a part in this. I mean, how can a free agent no longer be a free agent because you have to pay €10 million, €10 million, just to cross the line? What is that agent doing that's so special? I mean, I'm pretty sure I could sell Cavani. It's not that hard of a job. And I just think we all lose out for this. That €10 million is going to come out somehow out of fans or clubs, or I was saying this, in every little way, clubs are being rinsed more and more, and it's kind of taken away from the culture of our, it's the reason now you need to get an extra shirt sponsor and kids have to look even more like a NASCAR. And it's just like, things like that where I'm starting to realize, like, just it's everyone's trying to get rinse a dollar out of every club, even the big clubs I feel sorry for, because you got to somehow make that money back. And to make that money back, you either got to raise ticket prices or you got to kind of sell your club as more of a kind of a sponsor board, or you got to do something and constantly cut wages back, fire people. And it's just like, we don't see it on the surface, but you see things like, you know, Arsenal and go 55 people, as well as their mascot of who's been there since 93, what's that, 27 years. Why? So you can give Willian an extra 150. For me, that's the depressing part. Sky, I don't know, man, it makes a dull Monday in September or October this time pretty interesting for me. But for me, it's the money. Like, I just think FIFA have to stamp out the agents, and it's just, I just don't know how it ends. It's such a cliche, the game's gone, but 10 million for a free agent, like, think about 10 million, you know, how many clubs are about to go bust, literally on the wall in the conference. And it's, again, that's such a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. Like, I don't know what people want us to say. Why do you need 10 million from, is £1 million not enough for you? Like,
I'd be very happy with £1 million from you.
Yeah. I mean, it is literally for a printer to print out the contracts and give it and put it in front of him. Like, that is, and you know, he's not really brokering a deal, as you say, like, he's a free agent.
This is the problem. They said that with the, I was reading this really interesting article about the Sancho transfer, in that United put their foot down, not because of what Dortmund wanted, but what the agent wanted. And usually, or in the old days, it was the agent took a fee from the player. Now the agents want money from the clubs. That's what Raiola's really changed. So, like, United had to pay the agent, not Sancho. He had to pay the agent £30 million. Is it really worth it?
Yeah, I mean, as you said there, it's fan pressure. It's like pressure from the media. I guess some clubs just go, right, and it's obviously then pressure on the pitch as well, because they're not performing. So then they go out there and they're like, and the agents, and they're like, God, why not? Like, they just literally make up a number.
Supply and demand, isn't it?
Supply and demand. Yeah. We've got the best talent. on our books, where we're getting 20% anyway of, you know, the fee, and then, you know, agent fees on top of that. It's, yeah, it's crazy money.
Maybe
you
they,
said you
maybe
said before
lost 6-3 instead of
6-3. Yeah, exactly. you said before you could flog Cavani in the market. I want to ask, do you reckon you could do as good a job of flogging Choupo-Moting, who then went from PSG to Bayern Munich?
I always rated him at Stoke, though. I had him in my fantasy. No, because he used to do bits at Schalke. He got me a lot of points on fantasy that no one else ever earned. So I've always rated him, to be fair.
But PSG level? Bayern Munich level? Really?
Miss of the century as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the best agent in the world by a mile to be getting those deals done.
Yeah, for sure. He was instrumental in Atalanta's loss to the PSG, though, so he can burn in hell for all I care.
It's not worth asking.
He shot Bambi. They shot Bambi.
They shot Bambi.
I think we touched on it before about, you know, obviously we haven't had fans in the stadium, you know, we're losing money, maybe 6 million per match day. Yet Premier League clubs have spent 1.2 billion in the transfer window during a pandemic without fans. How is that even possible? Mm. And it's quite worrying that, you know, we were talking about even the Gunnosaurus incident, and there's been redundancies throughout Arsenal. There's been talks of obviously people being on furlough within clubs and things like that. How is it possible that these clubs are spending such big money on transfers whilst making the redundancies and not letting fans in either?
It's crazy. It's like, you know, you look at the clubs and obviously the money from TV and the money from, as you were saying earlier, it's like, you know, the different sponsorship deals that they're having to do, but it is that pressure to then spend this ridiculous money on players, isn't it? I think there was a lot of statements out from chairmans being like, don't expect a big summer because, like, it's going to be tight, and then it just never materialised.
Do you think there's a link between, well, there is a definite link, but it's a weird link between the fact that it seems like a lot of English clubs are signing a lot of really, really good players, and it doesn't seem like that was really ever happened before. Like, that I suppose that just piles on onto that same question, is how is that happening? Is there some kind of fiscal advantage of them coming to the UK? Are we just like being exploited in a way in the Premier League?
That could be it, actually.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I've heard that before.
We've nailed it.
we're exclusive. No, but I've read about that before as well, about how like a lot of clubs from outside of the UK hold Premier League clubs to ransom because they know you've got bigger TV deals. They know you've got the cash. You know how wealthy the league is. And so let's say a 15 million pound player suddenly becomes a 23 million pound player, even an extra five. It's like, we know you're the Prem. We know how much you get in. Was it a 5.6 billion pound just domestic TV deal? So they hold them to ransom. You know, you look at the NBA in American sports, and they do it so well. Everything's so fair, and teams who are struggling are able to be helped out. But the problem with football is it's international. So you've got different countries and different regulations and laws. And I don't think it's even coming close to an end yet. I think it's still going to get worse, and it's still going to get worse. Did you hear about Serginho? What's the guy who's gone from Ajax to Barcelona? Serginho Dest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Guess what his release clause is?
It'd be something ridiculous like
150 million.
400 million.
400 million is right.
Ooh, wow. I did not look that up.
You definitely
I'd like
knew
to
that.
Put that.
You have
like
to put your phone away, Ken.
Yeah.
I just Googled it.
400 million.
Jesus.
But that's a workaround, though.
He's not worth 400. Like, if he's worth 400, I'm worth 200.
He got done dirty there, because that was an edit. That was a major edit. Yeah. He did some pretty good skills, to be fair.
Because they flog him for the whole time.
We haven't even seen the biggest transfer that's yet to come, because it's probably nailed on that Messi is going, you know, next summer, 100%.
Yeah,
but he'll go for free.
I know he'll go for free, but there must be some type of an agent fee involved as well. I mean,
good point.
It's not a free agent if the agent's not free.
And you're not going to let Lionel Messi go on a free if you're his agent, are you? He's one main massive move that's left for him, probably.
That's the one where they'll go to City and be like, well, you're not paying a fee, so
we'll charge you 400 million in agent fee.
Yeah, here's your agent fee.
So I think you were talking about it with regards to the NBA in terms of teams helping out other teams. And I think there's a lot of counterpoints as well to this point around Premier League clubs need to be helping EFL clubs. Mm. Obviously, in some ways, it makes sense because you look at the players, the clubs that are rich, and you think, you know, help the poor, a bit, you know, Robin Hood-esque. But, you know, is it their responsibility? Is the counter argument? You know, I think when it comes to teams personally that are going out of business, then maybe they're
out of business last week. Was it Macclesfield or?
Believe so, yeah. It was Macclesfield.
And you think that, like, that 10 million, for example, on the agent's fees, you'd given it, they weren't even millions in debt. It was like 500 grand or something like that. The difference of 10 million to a team like Macclesfield, that's the difference of, you know, having your club and not having your club.
Yeah. I mean, that's why seeing 1.2 billion be spent in the Premier League when they said, oh, it's going to be tough and made redundancies and stuff like that. And then there are clubs whose only income really is fans in the stadium.
But surely that's actually the FA's, you know, job to kind of keep the smaller clubs and try and bail them out. It's not necessary. It shouldn't actually necessarily, in their defence, be Premier League clubs to help out the Championship and lower leagues. It should actually come from the FA, because we all know they're not short of money. We all know how much they take home in bonuses each year. So should it come from there?
Yeah, but that's nothing compared to the money that the Premier League's swimming in. And again, as I read, shout out to The Athletic, but like, an article which showed how many lower league clubs have kind of been the basis, like for the England national team, and of course these Premier League clubs, you know, from Harry Kane to John Stones, lower league clubs are the places these players have formed and been given time to be loaned out to build their skills. And I think for far too long we forget, and this isn't just about Spurs or anyone really, but everyone forgets that, yes, there's a top six and there's even a Premier League, but that Premier League has to sit on top of something. And that sits on the history, the culture, and the general status of 100-year-old clubs that are part of this kind of environment and this community. And this, they make the hub of four national divisions and create the culture of football in England. And it's vital that all of them stay alive. And do we need to have clubs dying when you're paying £45 million for a defender? No, it's like all it takes is a couple of million from every club to put into a kitty to help these clubs out. And not just clubs, but communities. Like, these clubs are communities. Macclesfield, Bury, you know, the list goes on. Coventry obviously survived now. I was talking about Chester, who went to the wall a decade or so ago. These clubs are more than just clubs. They're communities, and they are almost the foundations of what the Premier League sits on top of. You only make the Champions League because you beat 20 other teams and 72 on top of that. Like, you have to remember that you're not isolated. It's like a family, you know what I mean? Like, it really is, at the end of the day, a family that you sit on top of, yes, and you are the best. But, like, don't forget about the ones who are down below. And yes, the FA could help if they could, but they don't have the money the Prem does.
Yeah, I think it's sort of supporting that ecosystem around you, isn't it? And it's appreciating that, yeah, you might be at the top right now. Not to say that's necessarily the case forever. It's not to say that a different set of circumstances 100 years ago would have meant that, for better comparison, you know, yeah, Spurs were where Leyton Orient are and Leyton Orient are where Spurs are now. It's one of those things where I think, I totally get what you're saying. And the money those Premier League clubs have, you sort of think, yeah, I agree. They'll sort of, like, you know, push the line of, well, where does it stop, sort of thing. But I think like Elliot was saying, when it gets to those points where these clubs are seriously in danger, like they are now, of going out of business, surely at that point you put all those politics aside and just say, all right, well, in order for like the greater good, let's just sort of do the right thing, and then that will support. Like you said, they have to sit on top of something, don't they?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that makes British football so great is the strength of these clubs down to the fourth division. You go into the third division of even Italian football, and it's amateur. Like you go to League One, and there's still massive clubs in there, like Sunderland. It's just what England has is so cool and so unique, and it's like the love is so strong. Even, I mean, you could even say in the Conference, Notts County, you've got such amazing historic teams that, to see them go, it's beyond. It's not just, oh, that's a shame. Like, oh, they were. It's like, no, they are institutions of English culture, and they shouldn't go because if you can save them for less than it costs a defender, then I'm sorry, but like, we owe it. The game, whoever can help needs to help. as far as I'm concerned.
Especially if that defender's Harry Maguire as well. obviously, you've touched on it a lot there in terms of how you feel and how passionate you are about it. Just sort of wanted to ask you sort of about your sort of stance and the fact that you've sort of built this career around football fan culture. And so, like, what is it why are you so passionate about that side of the game when I think so many others are? They sort of take their passion from, you know, the individual matches and the stats and the goals and specific teams. What is it about the wider landscape that you love so much?
Well, for me, I mean, the real heart of it is, you know, I try to explain to people, like, you guys all love this game, whether you like it or not, like, through the lens of a club, whether it's your mum or your dad or grandfather who brought it down to you, and you've got the nostalgia of being Spurs and it's in your family. It's probably one of your first Christmas presents or whatever. Like, I didn't, but that is the reality. Like, your football is usually through a lens of a club, or if not then your national team. But I didn't grow up with football. I grew up with Australian sports, and I fell in love with football because I was like, why are these people so batshit about this, like, more than any other sport? Like, and why can I learn so much about the world through these? I can't. Every country that I seem to go to, I always say it was like 2002 World Cup that changed everything for me, because I'm like, I haven't heard of these countries before. And I was always obsessed with geography. And I was like, what's Senegal? And then, like, you learn about it. Or, like, that sounds ridiculous, but when you're 12 and you're from Australia, like, and you're like, now I know about Dakar and, like, the capital of Senegal, I can talk about it. And that's how I fell in love with it, through the geography of it and through the fans. And then what that built was, like, I don't have a club because I tried to pretend. I didn't try, but, like, I did a gap year, like every dickhead Aussie. Wait, so I'm just talking about where I did. I lived in Shepherd's Bush, so I went for QPR. But, like, at the end of the day, when they sang "I'm QPR till I die" or "I'm Orange," I couldn't sing it because I'm like, I don't think I am actually. Like, I'm not willing to die for this club. I just, it's not in me because it's not in my childhood and my family. And I found that hard to take seriously. So instead, I just kind of became obsessed naturally with just watching it all as a neutral and documenting it, and also, as you know, laughing at it at times, and just being able to, like, enjoy all the storylines and narratives. And but mostly I'm obsessed with how obsessed fans are obsessed with it.
It does sound like a very nice footballing life to not have to follow a team. It sounds like it could add a couple of years to your life rather than taking off the years.
Yeah, my flatmates say that. I live with them, and I just, one's Arsenal, one's Chelsea, and I just laugh at both of them. Like, whenever, like, they never get to laugh at me because I don't have a team, so I just get to laugh with them. But I do get caught up in narratives and stuff, and, like, I felt physically sick when Atalanta got knocked out. Like, I was shaking, and I always say the one with Atletico Madrid, that first Champions League final that I lost to Real Madrid, I don't think I spoke about football for a week and I cried. Like, I get caught up in these narratives of underdog stories and this and that. So I do have my moments, don't get me wrong. And then obviously the national team for Australia, I'm a massive, massive supporter of. So,
without fans in stadiums at the moment, have you, like most people, I think, been less interested in games and the narratives and the stories around them? Or have you actually, has it not made a huge impact?
I said I wouldn't. And then I did, like, I really said I wouldn't. And then I even said, like, okay, I got into it because it was the end of the season. So obviously we were at the culmination, we're at the business end, the exciting end. Okay, I'll get into it the lot, you know, when they wrapped up 2019, 2020, I was like, okay, well, I can get into this because I can see the end, but I'm not getting into a new season. That's just not going to happen. But I think I've watched every match of the day so far. so, like, well, what about you guys as Spurs fans? Like, have you felt you're more into it, less into it? Like, you got a brand new stadium, one of your best squads of all time, and it doesn't look like you're coming back for a while. Have you felt a bit, I don't know, distanced?
As a match-going fan, like, regularly, every week, absolutely, it's not the same.
No.
Because, and I said it on last week's show, that football is about memories, and it's about, for me anyway, and it's about, like, the people I share the experiences with. And whilst sitting at home with Cameron watching TV is great, and we can jump up and down and hug and stuff. Like, I don't see every weekend or every other weekend, I used to see my grandpa, my uncle at the football, and we used to talk about football, and it was great.
Go to the calf.
Yeah. And you just, yeah.
It's a day out.
And I'm getting emotional.
It's true. It is about the whole build up to the game. It's about, you wake up in the morning, you know, you get football, you get prepared, you get on the train, you get in the car, you go to the pub, you go have lunch. Like, it's a whole build up. to you know, the game, before you even get to the game. And then it's the experience at the game, and then leaving, whether you're in a really awful mood or you're in a great mood and you're buzzing and you can't wait to go out that night and just tell everyone how good your team is, and then get home from match of the day. Like, it does take it away from, you know, you obviously watch these great games. We had a great weekend last weekend, but, and obviously it would have been away, but if you were a fan at that game, imagine how buzzing you would have been. Yeah. And then come back and go into work on the Monday and rub it in everyone's face. Like, it's just, it does take it away. So I guess we can just only hope that we get back in. I mean, before actually we were talking, and I think the Premier League tweeted an open letter to fans I was reading, pretty much saying, we're doing our part. It's just, you know, blame the government, pretty much.
Yeah.
So we can only hope.
Can I ask you guys, if let's say you made the cup final, because I read an interview with a Newcastle fan when they made the quarters and it was still locked down. And he's like, I actually don't want to win this because I don't want the first FA Cup in my lifetime to be, but like, it would just hurt. It's not actually what, I don't want to win an FA Cup. As much as I'll enjoy it, like, I don't want that to be my experience. If you guys say made the semis, would you be, I mean, obviously naturally you want to win it, but like, would you really want to win the first one that you remember behind closed doors?
There's a part of me where I think, like, the way I think as a fan is you have those moments and you bank them, they don't come very often. So I'll be like, I'm cashing my chips at the wrong time. That's how I feel. I think, like, there is a side of that. I mean, even just going back to the other point, it's like there's times when you're sitting at home and you have a dreadful performance or you lose it and you think, thank God I don't have to walk down Seven Sisters High Road now and like in pouring rain. But then, like you said, it's those moments make it all sweeter as well. And I think, like, the cup run last year, for any club going on a cup run or something, I think, if this year is like the year that you look back on and you look at all the archives for and you know that no one's there, I think, yeah, it will be a little bit bittersweet.
There are definitely moments where you're like, you know, you're watching something and you're obviously, you know, like the 6-1 or, you know, beating, you know, winning at home or whatever it is.
Villa
and you're like,
Villa beating Liverpool.
Yeah. I mean, they said afterwards
and they said, like, you know, it's just this massive shame that we couldn't be there to experience it.
Imagine that. Imagine the scenes. Imagine.
Yeah.
But would that have happened? There was a very interesting thing today on TalkSport, or I think it was today or yesterday, and they were saying that there's the percentage of away clubs winning is like 61% at the minute, and usually it's 25%. So the difference of having fans in the club and not at the game, you know, away fans, home fans, it's massive, because now any team can kind of go to any ground and get away with a result. They go 1-0 up, they haven't got the pressure of, you know, the home crowd on their back, and so I mean it kind of does make for a more fair game. But I mean, you're just missing the main part of football, which is fans.
Well, it's newly promoted sides as well, isn't it? Like, maybe Fulham's a bad example. They're not exactly the most raucous fans of all time. But, like, you know, if Sheffield United had their fans in, would their season be as bad as it is now? Like, they're not winning games. They had such a good season last season, and they fell off as well when fans weren't allowed in. So, like, can you look at that and be like, you know, that might lose Chris Wilder his job? Like,
you look at Leeds waiting all that time to finally get back to, like, the promised land, and you can't even be there.
One of my Leeds mates, I won't name him because he'll get arrested, but he went to he went up from London to Leeds to celebrate. Obviously, it was a lockdown period, wasn't it? But I don't blame him. I thought that was the question you were going to ask, Ellie. Like, would you go to the outside Wembley?
Absolutely.
And I probably would.
Would you?
Yeah.
I think so.
I think now,
not if any police are listening to this, we would stay.
We'll be self-isolating for 14 days.
We would also
indoors.
Well, we don't have the virus, but we would do it at social distance.
But like, do you really want to celebrate at a social? You want to hug the person?
No,
I remember you always tell me about that bar when, what's his name scored the third goal against Ajax. Like, there were literally people you don't know hugging each other, like just.
Yeah, that bloke put his head into the TV.
How can you win your first FA Cup in your life and not have limbs? Like, just kind of like be next to one person or in your inner six. Like, it's, I don't know. It's just a weird version of it. And you really want a weird version. Then again, you know what? Like, beggars can't be choosers. There's not much to be, you know, to be excited about at the moment. So I guess better than nothing, maybe. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you'd prefer to have it, wouldn't you, than not have it at the moment? Like, the early parts of lockdown with no football.
I guess maybe to win another one, but I feel like to win your first, do you know what I mean, is something a bit different. Like, it's your first, like, you want your first to be, tell your kids, but the first one was the best one. Not like the first one. I was in I was at home watching in the office.
So obviously you consider yourself Mr. International Break, and to be fair to you, a lot of other people do as well. Is there sort of Would you say it is definitely your favourite time of the season? And what is it about the international break that you do love so much? Because even just spending time with you, you are obsessed with it.
Usually it's my favourite time of the season, not at the moment, obviously, with everything going on. With the reason I love it is because, like I said, everyone, it means that every football fan gets to be part of the main conversation. Again, everyone, a lot of people in England, and to be fair, Europe, forget that, like, football is the world game and everyone around the world is obsessed, and as much as you can be the biggest fucking as much as you can be the biggest Chelsea fan from Ecuador, the Tottenham till you die from Sydney, the reality is you that club doesn't serve your purpose. That those players aren't from where that club is, and obviously, I mean, they're not really from Tottenham anymore anyway, but the point being, it's the one time that everyone gets to feel like the place that they're really from, or at least they're connected to, is part of it. And I also love the idea that, and everyone forgets that the World Cup was for a month, and everyone loves the World Cup. I've never heard anyone argue with the World Cup, but to get to the World Cup takes 3 years. And whilst, yes, the England journey is usually a couple of Eastern European teams and one challenger, and you walk into the tournament, for most people, especially in South America, especially in Africa, and especially in Asia, it's this mad journey of stadium 6,000 feet in the air in Bolivia, and, you know, old relics of stadiums in Bhutan, and having to go away in Afghanistan as Australia. And, like, it's a proper journey. It's like what's that movie, Around the World in 80 Days? It's a proper experience that players don't have to be part of, and they choose to just represent their country. It's not fun to go away on these games, and it's just, I feel like it's so much more pure, and it's, at the end of the day, players want to play for their country. It's something deeper than the salary or the team or, like, the status. It's like, I'm from here. I love it. You see with Bale, like, the man's won so many trophies, you know, Champions Leagues, La Ligas, Copa del Rey, but it's when he plays for Wales that the smile comes on his face. And that's because it's like, it's who he's from. He's representing the people he went to school with. He's representing the people, you know, the postman delivered his post. That's what it means. And it's so pure, and it's just this beautiful 3 year journey. And not to mention the narratives are just, I mean, the narratives are ridiculous. Every time I think this can't get more ridiculous, something bonkers happens. And that's why I love it.
You touched on that. Is there any stories right now that maybe people aren't aware of, any narratives that are sort of building that are, like, really exciting you?
Well, the problem with this one international break is, so you've got, what, 6 federations? 2 of them aren't even playing. They've just cancelled all World Cup qualifiers until the new year. So CONCACAF, which is Central and North America, so your Caribbean islands, America, Mexico and Canada, they've just said, we can't do it because of regulations with many countries with quarantine in. We're not going to do the qualifiers yet. And Asia's just said it's impossible with the way that area of the world suffering with the pandemic. So usually we have those two kicking off. So we've got no CONCACAF, no Asia. Europe, obviously it's Nations League. It's not World Cup qualifiers yet. However, people should be excited about is we've got the playoffs for the Euros. Like, people don't realize not every team's even qualified for the Euros yet. Not only has the Euros not happened, not all the teams have qualified. Like, you've still got your 8 playoffs for the 4 final spots. Some incredible fixtures. You've got the one I've keeping my eye out on in Europe is Scotland. Haven't made a tournament for 22 years. Obviously, none of us remember them being in a tournament, but for years on end, they made 98, they made 86, they made 90, I'm pretty sure. They were a proper team in the international tournaments, and now they're hosting the next international tournament. Hampden Park has games, and they are absolutely desperate to get in. So they've got Israel. It'll be an interesting game. Who also haven't made it for years. The winner, and it's one-off game, so the winner will play Norway and Serbia. And again, that's really interesting. Odegaard and Haaland, the chance to make their first tournament against Serbia. Serbia not so interesting, but, you know, a Scotland-Norway playoff as a one-off game. I don't care what club you go for. Like, that's a fascinating fixture. And then, of course, so you've got playoffs for each of the leagues of the nation. Even I find this hard to remember, but basically there's a playoff for A, B, C and D. And what's really interesting about D is obviously the minnows, and that's what it was brought in. Whoever topped those 4 groups in the D league got to play off for a spot in the Euros. None of those countries have ever made it, except for Latvia, I think. But the 4 who are left, who are playing off, now. You've got Kosovo, North Macedonia, Georgia, and Belarus. Four tiny nations who, if they win two games of football, one of them are going to get to be in the Euros. One of them being Kosovo, who were at their first ever attempt at qualifying for Euros, and they might make it. Tiny Kosovo, who didn't even exist as a football nation. And then you might even then say, yeah, but I still don't care about Kosovo. But you probably didn't care about Iceland until they made the Euros, and then all of a sudden everyone was doing the Viking clap and we were all falling in love with them. Yeah, of course, like England, that's the thing. Everyone doesn't realise, like, these minnows that we love in the tournament, they have to get there somehow, and their journey is often even more insane than how they got there. Panama is a great example from the World Cup. Like, we all loved Panama being in the World Cup, but what was really insane is how they got there, which you're going to need to give me an hour to get into that. But yeah, what I'm trying to say is, like, there's so many narratives that, yes, it's frustrating that your club's just got momentum and it's stopped, but, like, at the expense of Kosovo fans not getting to watch their team? Like, no, like, get over yourselves and just embrace this and go, it's not changing, and it's good that it's not changing, because football's about more than the club game, and embrace it. And then obviously, so that's Europe covered. So the other place where there'll be games is Europe, Africa possibly. No, I don't think so. And South America, the World Cup qualifiers for South America start. And they are the best qualifiers of all, because you've got, it's only 10 teams, one home and away each. So it's knockout. Everyone has to play the best teams. Everyone has to play the minnows. You have to play in the stadiums, 10,000 feet in the air. And like I said, it's just brilliant. And arguably the most brilliant of all is the Bolivia games, because Bolivia play in the highest altitude, in a stadium in the highest altitude in the world. And all the teams will play two games in this window, and it's Argentina-Bolivia in La Paz in Bolivia. And that is the famous location where Messi, Aguero, Mascherano took on Bolivia for the 2014 World Cup, the one where they made the final. This is that team, and they lost 6-1 to Bolivia.
Just because they were knackered.
They were knackered, but, like, how brilliant is that? That Bolivia, name me one Bolivian. I can't remember a Bolivian player since that Boa Vista captain. Like, Bolivia beat Argentina 6-1. And, you know, it's great because obviously what you get in this as well is, like, geopolitical rivalries take part in all of this, obviously. So, like, Argentina sits under Bolivia, and Argentines are very snobby towards Bolivians. They look down on them. Argentina's a much wealthier nation. But on that day, this nation that's laughed in the face of their neighbours for a century was humiliated in the sport they love the most, with their arguably one of their best ever squads. And Bolivians still talk about it. Like, 6-1 is etched in the history of Bolivia now whenever Argentinians talk to them, and the qualifiers allowed them to have that. And I just think that's brilliant.
If there was one game you could go to from this round of international breaks, if fans were allowed in, what would you pick?
You know what? That's a great question. I'd probably pick a South American one deeper in the tournament, because that's always the best. But what I would say is, yeah, I'd have to be in Scotland, because it's a playoff. It's a one-off playoff. And they have to be at the Euros, man. It's, even though their squad is crap. Like, they need Hampden Park. Hampden Park is brilliant. They've had so many heartbreaks the last few years. Obviously, a colleague of ours, Finn has kind of got me, a Scottish editor I work with, he's got me to fall in love with them. But long story short, I just think Scottish football fans are so brilliant, and tournaments have been worse off for not having them at least once. So I think
it's funny when England beat them.
it is. But, like, I'd love to be in Hampden Park if they got the win over Israel, and then to watch them. Like, that. Oh, honestly, that's my pick.
It's a great pick. So we'll move on to what you're obviously very famous for, which is Derby Days, and probably one of the biggest ones that you had the privilege of being at was the River Plate and Boca game, and in the Superclásico. Could you describe that game, that experience? I think for everyone, it's like, it's bucket list. It's the top of the bucket list, really, for a football fan to experience. But yeah, what was that experience for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those ones, again, a cliche, but, like, words can't describe it. They really can't. Because until you're there and you feel like, the best way to describe it for me is, like, over the years, having been privileged enough to be able to go to some of the biggest derbies, and not just derbies that you and I consider, but the ones that I've always wanted to go to. You know, I wasn't really that excited by the Milan derby, but to be at the Hamburg derby was like a big deal for me because it's almost less famous, but it's hard to get tickets because there's no real tourist market. So I've gotten to go to the biggest games, World Cup quarterfinals, Champions League finals, Europa League finals. But for me, basically what that did was I stopped getting excited about games because you'd been to the bigger one and bigger one and bigger one. But walk into that one, it's like it came back. It was like the first series of derby days when I got excited again. Like I became like a kid in a candy store, and I always bring it back. We did a thing called Derby Days Diaries, a little extra video to explain what happened behind the scenes. Because that's the thing, people thought it was fun. It wasn't fun. It was truly, it was 3 weeks of horrific anxiety, and we had to get the edit done before the game even finished. And a guy, you guys will know, Igal, I'll never forget, the staff member turning to me and being like, Ellie, I've never ending butterflies. And I was like, yeah, welcome to Derby Days, mate. It's just not fun. We weren't, there were days we wouldn't eat because the combination, we'd feel sick and we didn't have time. And I need to get that through first because it wasn't actually that fun trying to document such a mad 3 weeks. But as I said on Derby Days Diaries, there was this moment where another thing is like, people think we have permission to film in there. We had no permission. We had Amstel, through our Amstel sponsorship, we were allowed to photograph the first 10 minutes before kickoff, and somehow I just blagged. I argued with a guy for 40 minutes to get us on the pitch. Like we heard we might be able to, but we didn't think it was possible. And one of the cameramen was like, Ellie, leave it. We'll never get on the pitch. And I just kept going. I don't even know why I kept going. I didn't believe I'd get on. And finally he relented. So you got 5 minutes, and he walked us through, like, it's not a tunnel. It's like, up towards the pitch, and then he opens this giant glass, because they've got glass barriers on the front because the fans will jump on the pitch if they're not happy. So they have to have these massive glass barriers like in Argentina, and it's a slide one where no fans are allowed. It's not for the players. It's just for a general, I don't know, logistics. He slides it open. It was like being, as Johnny said, it was like being fed to the lions in the Colosseum, as every fan's like, synchronized banging on the glass. And he literally pushed us onto the pitch and then closed it again, because I have to close it just in case fans break into that section. And then just fans bashing it and screaming at us as if we've got something to do with it. And I remember, like, I did a circle, like, just, I didn't even mean to. I just did that, you know, that kind of cliche, like, just did a spin on my own and was like, where am I? And it was just, nothing has come close and nothing will come close to what it was. It wasn't just a moment in sporting history. It was a moment in cultural history for Argentina, that game. It really is like those two teams, institutions in the culture and history of the country, and not in a sporting context. And so for them to meet in that first one ever, that was always the thing. Everyone always said, why didn't you do that derby? And I always said, I don't want to do that derby. It's almost too good. It's too perfect. You couldn't document it. I wouldn't want to go there and not do justice to that derby.
It's like, don't meet your heroes, but actually sometimes it's the best thing that can happen.
Yeah. 2 years later, it's like, yeah, that was fun. But they really are like, again, it's such, I know I keep saying cliche. I hate cliches. So I hate them. Oh, it's, you've never seen anything like it. Everyone says that. But at that derby, I'd never seen anything like what I saw. They're just.
Imagine telling them it's just a game.
Yeah. No, you can't in Argentina. It's, again, it's, but I, everyone's like, where's the most passionate football country? And like, well, then it must be Argentina. I'm like, well, not really. I think it's more, because I think in England, you've got, passion is kind of expressed differently. And in Argentina, they do everything to extremes, like everything. The way they eat, the way they're obsessed with wine, the way they, I even said, like, relationships. Everyone either seems to be like madly in love or having horrific breakups. Like, Argentinians just, everything's dramatic. Everything's like a telenova. Like, really, to the point where it's toxic, and that, and their football is their most loved kind of pastime. So they live that to this way that's like, it's just the way I've explained it. So it's just like, man, just take a break, guys. But that's how they feel. And, you know, that's like why you love football, because you learn about all this other stuff when through their football. And yeah, basically, it was a two-legged fixture that had five match days, and we went to one, we got to see one actual game. So I think that sums up just how mad that was.
Amazing. Awesome. Yeah, so I think, you know, we've got some incredible stories there. And if you've been listening to the previous episodes, which I'm sure you have,
definitely have, haven't you, Ellie?
As one of our loyal friends and followers.
Oh, he actually has been listening.
Love it.
Well, the first 2 seconds.
Yes. So we call...
heard the catchphrase, I'm out.
So we call this Against the Runner Play. So it's a bit of a quick fire round where, yeah, just say the first answer that comes to your head. You ready?
No, hold on, let me prepare for this. I made some preparations, but...
You can't prepare for this.
I mean, you're going to embarrass yourself or it'll be great.
Hold on 1 sec. Okay, all right.
There's no wrong answer, but you will be judged. No,
they're pretty straightforward. First one, Messi or Ronaldo?
Messi.
Nike or Adidas?
Oh... Do you have to choose one?
You have to choose one.
Yeah, Nike then.
Lampard or Gerrard?
Oh, Gerrard. Lampard's a Tory, isn't he?
That's the quote. 40-yard screamer or tiki-taka team goal?
Is this individual... You know, I want to go tiki-taka because that Jack Wilshere goal, I know you guys don't want to talk about that, but like...
No, I was just thinking...
That's basically porn. I'd rather be part of that.
Than score a 40-yard screamer on your own.
Yeah. Nah, that goal, man.
If you were a manager, would you be a suit manager or a tracksuit manager?
I'm not cool enough to pull off a tracksuit, so I have to say suit.
Boca or River?
Nah, I'm not saying that, man.
You have to.
No. Guys, do you understand? Country. This puts myself. Okay, you know, I'll be honest. No, I can't. Like,
no, you can. You can't do that. You can't do that.
I prefer the Boca jerseys. How's that? I really like Boca's jersey.
That's a very political answer.
It's a cop out.
It'll do.
I'd rather cop out than live. And
Tim Cahill or Harry Kewell?
Love them both, but Tim Cahill is just, he's the greatest sportsman of the last decade or so for Australia. So, Tim Cahill.
I'm glad you're Australia.
Brilliant. I think that's us wrapped up, mate. Thank you so much for that. That was great.
Pleasure, man. That was fun.
Yeah,
fun.
Thanks for coming on, Ellie. And yeah, listen out for the pod.
Yeah, we'll do. And sorry for that first 10 minutes. I'm glad it ran a bit smoother after that.
No, it's all worth it. We'll put that at the start, make it really unfair.
That'll be the first 10 minutes of the podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks, Ellie.
Speak soon.
Bye. Thanks for listening to episode 8 of the Run of Play podcast, and a special thanks to Ellie for joining us this week, giving us some incredible insight into football fan culture and his mental job. Please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and drop us a rating if you're feeling generous. You can also follow us at Run of Play Pod on Twitter and Instagram for more content. Run of Play will be back very soon with another expert guest, so stay tuned.